As the American soda industry mobilizes to fight Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney's tax on sugary drinks, a group is formed to promote his proposal. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. WHYY's Katie Culinary has more on the effort to win the hearts and minds of Philadelphians as well as city council members.
At a press conference last week, Kenney introduced Philadelphians for a Fair Future, a coalition that includes education advocates, the NAACP, and the unions representing teachers and service workers.
You're going to hear a lot from Big Soda. It's going to be an air war. It's going to be a ground war. And there are going to be lobbyists out the wazoo, right? And they're going to be making big money doing it. These are my lobbyists.
Kenney was making the point that his backers are citizens, not well-heeled commercial interests. But the reality is that the group is going to need some serious money to respond to the American Beverage Association's radio and social media campaign calling the mayor's proposal a grocery tax. And it's not clear just who will be paying for the campaign to support the soda tax. Last week, Philadelphians for a Fair Future filed with the IRS as a private nonprofit. Under the city's lobbying law, the group only has to report its donors if it engages in lobbying. And then, only donors who give 10% or more of everything it gets in a given reporting period. Shane Kramer heads Philadelphia's ethics board.
So if they have no funders over 10%, if they're all below 10%, they would not have to disclose the sources of their funding.
The same rules apply, by the way, to the American Beverage Association fighting the tax. And here's the other catch. These groups have to submit reports about their spending only if they spend more than $2,500 in a calendar quarter. Plus, it's likely they would not have to report most of their spending until months after City Council considers the tax. Kevin Feely, a spokesman for the pro-tax group, says he expects Philadelphians for a Fair Future will report its spending and go beyond what the law requires by disclosing its donors.
We want to be as transparent as we can be. We anticipate that at some point, donors and amounts will become public.
Although Feely would not say how or when that would happen. Katie Culinary, WHYY News.
Atlantic City will effectively have to shut down next month because it's running out of money. But as WHYY's Joe Hernandez reports, city officials are hoping they can tide themselves over for a few weeks while seeking a more permanent solution to the city's problems.
Mayor Don Guardian promises that essential service providers, including police, fire, and sanitation, would remain on the job. They would be paid when the city gets its next round of tax payments in early May. But Guardian said at a press conference in City Hall that many non-essential workers have also agreed to keep working come April 8th.
I can tell it's not going to look any different than today, except we're probably going to have about 20,000 people in town for the largest beer festival on the East Coast.
Guardian is seeking a short-term state loan of $9 million so the city won't have to cease operations, but Governor Chris Christie has refused. Christie told WPG Radio that no additional aid is going to the Seaside Resort until the legislature approves a state takeover, which is being held up over a provision allowing the state to break public union contracts.
I'm not doing this just because I want my way. I know that this is what's needed to be able to get their finances into order, to exempt an entire class of people, public sector union workers, from having to be part of the solution is just bald politics.
Guardian says even if Atlantic City manages to make it through this three-week shutdown on the goodwill of city workers, they will face the same problem all over again in just a few weeks. From the New Jersey desk, I'm Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
E-Verify. It's a government program allowing employers to double-check the legal status of any federal worker. It's also the subject of one of a trio of new bills in the Pennsylvania State House aimed at tightening immigration policy statewide. Details from WHYY's Laura Benchoff.
Butler County State Representative Daryl Metcalf prefaced his bill, which would require all employers in Pennsylvania to use E-Verify, with some tough talk on immigration.
We need to do what we can here in Pennsylvania to stem that tide of illegal aliens that are coming into Pennsylvania in search of jobs, in search of benefits, and some of them in search of ways to harm American citizens.
E-Verify lets employers check the identification papers of job seekers against federal databases. Republican Metcalf's bill, co-sponsored by Democrat Dom Costa of Allegheny County, would fine employers who hire undocumented workers. While E-Verify is supposed to flag anyone using fake or expired documentation clerical errors have caused problems, says Gene Barr, the president of the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry.
There have been cases in other states where someone has been terminated improperly because of that E-Verify system, and the employer's liable for back wages, etc.
He says that makes employers skittish about the background checks. Immigration advocates also have concerns about false identification, pointing out that the system kicks out legal immigrants more than any other group. Andy Hoover of the Pennsylvania branch of the American Civil Liberties Union says mandating a national database also lays the groundwork for state surveillance, straight out of a George Orwell novel.
That's where you get into the problem that E-Verify, quite frankly, is the infrastructure for a national ID.
Mandatory E-Verify bills have been floated in Pennsylvania for at least 8 years with little movement. But the state did enact a law requiring all its contractors to use the program in 2012. A growing number of big companies, including Urban Outfitters, also use it voluntarily. Other immigration reforms in front of Pennsylvania's House include a bill to penalize cities that don't honor federal immigration hold orders and one to make sure undocumented immigrants aren't accessing benefits. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania is poised to become the 24th state to legalize medical marijuana, this after a bill cleared the state house last week. As WHYY's Todd Bookman reports, the measure would be the first in the nation to allow doctors to recommend the drug for patients with autism.
The medical marijuana plan moving through Harrisburg would let patients with conditions including cancer, Crohn's disease, or glaucoma use pot to alleviate symptoms with a doctor's okay. And though it wasn't in the original version of the bill, autism is also now one of the dozen or so qualifying conditions.
Some people have called me and asked me and said, why are you recommending this for autism? We're not recommending anything for anything. That's up to doctors to decide.
This is Representative Russ Diamond, a Republican from Lebanon County, who sponsored the autism amendment.
I thought it was important to include that option for those doctors if they see fit.
Diamond says he's heard from constituents about the benefits of using marijuana to treat both children and adults on the autism spectrum. But while there's anecdotal evidence, some opponents of the move point to a lack of scientific proof of pot's benefits, not just in people with autism, but for most conditions. While there have been some studies, federal restrictions are still in place, limiting the research opportunities. That's why Becky Stansky with the Marijuana Policy Project, a national advocacy group, says the Pennsylvania law could help shine more light on the drug's potential benefits.
It will open up to collecting more data on the effects of it, and I think that it will create more opportunities for us to learn more about how medical marijuana can help autistic patients.
The bill still needs the approval of the Senate, which greenlighted an earlier version of the legislation. Governor Tom Wolf says he would sign the measure into law. For WHYY News, I'm Todd Bookman.
Still ahead this evening, a new museum showcasing the history of young black women finds an unusual venue.
This is my house, so it is really and truly a living museum.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Your high school shop class is rebranding itself.
I think it used to be kind of, a dumping ground for troubled kids. And now it's for kids that want to go out there and they want to get a job.
I'm Molly Wood. How the U.S. workforce could benefit from more vocational high schools. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows NewsWorks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
Penn Arts and Sciences supports WHYY and presents How Hollywood is Spotlighting Social Change. The film Spotlight tells the story of the Boston Globe team that exposed the Roman Catholic Church's cover-up of abuse. Open to the public, no ticket required. A conversation with Spotlight's Oscar-winning screenwriter and producer Josh Singer, along with cast member Neil Huff, and a faculty panel, on Wednesday, March 30th at 4:30 p.m. at the Annenberg Center's Zellerbach Theater. Details at sas.upenn.edu.
Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. We're less than an hour out from tip-off in Louisville, Kentucky. Number 2 seed Villanova versus number 3 Miami in the NCAA men's basketball tournament. Let's get the skinny on the Sweet 16 South Regional matchup with Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Bob Ford. Bob, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Good to be with you, Dave.
Bob, for the uninitiated, it makes sense that Miami is in the South Regional. But with games being played this weekend at the Wells Fargo Center in Philadelphia, what's Villanova doing in Louisville?
Well, that's where the tournament committee chose to put them for the South Regional. And the reason they did is because they wanted to protect the number one seed of North Carolina, which was playing in the East Regional. Villanova probably would have been at the East Regional if they had won the Big East tournament, but they lost in the championship there, and they sort of lost their right to claim that they should stay in the East. So they got a pretty good seeding, number two, number eight overall in the country, number two in the South Regional, and it's not so bad.
Now, for those who are initiated, you'll recall that there were major upsets for Villanova in each of the last 2 years. They were out in the second round. They got that monkey off their backs. What's the biggest difference with this team versus the team of the last couple of years?
Well, honestly, Dave, at this time of year, a lot of it comes down to matchups, where you get up against a team that does the things very well that you don't stop. And sometimes you get up against a team that doesn't do things very well that you are good at stopping. They had a wonderful matchup against an Iowa team that I think they were made to beat to get here to the Sweet 16. Played terrific defense. They were able to really stretch the floor with their offense. And it was a team that, you know, I think they were set up to have a good game against. Some of the previous ones in other years haven't gone that way. And honestly, at this time of year, no matter how good or bad you are, sometimes it's just that luck of the draw of who you run up against.
So, are the Wildcats made to beat Miami?
It's a great, great matchup. And I tell you, Dave, I think this game is a coin flip, a number two versus number three seed in this regional. Both teams are very, very experienced. They both have a lot of seniors on their teams. They're not going to shake. You know, this moment is not going to be too big for them. It's going to come down to defense, I think, as these good games always do. Both teams play very tenacious man-to-man defense. And it's probably going to come down to little things like, you know, who makes more three-point shots. And sometimes that's, you know, the capricious bounce of the ball off the rim. So Villanova fans and Philadelphia fans in general should get ready for a ride, because I think it's going to be a close game.
In this era when stars only stay a year or maybe two, is this typical? Is it typical for Jay Wright that you have kids who stay on for junior and senior years?
It is typical for Jay's program. They tend to get four-year players who are going to be there for a while. Some other programs, the Louisvilles of the world, the Kentuckys of the world, the Dukes of the world, they go after the guys who might be one and done and might be moving on. This is a very experienced tournament this time around. Every year, maybe a dozen kids come out as freshmen and go in the first round of the NBA draft. And last year, eight of them were still playing in the Sweet 16 round. This year, Only maybe two, maybe three this year of guys that are going to be one and done are still alive in this tournament. This is much more of an experienced field, and I think Nova fits right into that.
And we're hearing overall there's parity in college basketball this year relative to previous years. Villanova, cross our fingers, could emerge, get into the Final Four.
Well, they're one of a number of teams who were number one ranked overall at some point during the regular season. And as you said, it has been a lot of parity. There were six or eight teams that had that ranking. And, yeah, they're as good as anybody. If they play as well as they did, particularly in the first half against Iowa last weekend, there isn't a team on earth that can beat them, and that includes the 76ers.
That's not saying much. A victory tonight would have them take on the winner of number one Kansas versus number five Maryland. Before I let you go, how about some props for Philadelphia Big Five basketball? Villanova and Temple and St. Joe all went to the dance.
Yeah, it was a very good year, and props for sure to Temple and St. Joe's for getting there, because that wasn't a sure thing. And neither of them got out of the first weekend, but they both played very, very good games. Temple lost right at the end. St. Joe's had a lead, I think 5-point lead with 7 minutes to go, and wasn't able to hold on against number one seed Oregon. So, yeah, both those programs had very, very good years. Hopefully Philadelphia can get together and sit back and enjoy Villanova's run.
Here's your chance. What are you expecting tonight?
It's a coin flip, but I really was encouraged by the way that Villanova played against Iowa. I think they're going to prevail, but I do think it's going to be a very, very narrow win, less than 5 points.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, Dave.
Philadelphia Inquirer sports columnist Bob Ford on Newsworks Tonight. There's the Franklin Institute, the Philadelphia Museum of Art, the African American History Museum, the Mummers Museum. But new on the Philadelphia museum scene is the Colored Girls Museum, a pop-up museum run out of the founder's home in Germantown. WHYY's Nima Rishania stopped by.
On a seemingly ordinary residential street in Philadelphia's Germantown neighborhood, Vashti Dubois is busy putting the final touches on the Colored Girls Museum's latest exhibit in her house. Walk into the museum and you'll see signs of everyday life everywhere. The kitchen doubles as an exhibit on ceramics and beading, the dining room an exhibit showcasing quilts and dolls. And cartoons are blasting from the TV, keeping Dubois' grandson amused while her daughter works on the museum's website. It's a family affair, she says. She's throwing open the doors to her home to mark Women's History Month by honoring everyday black women.
The museum's for all sorts of things, and we think that there should be a Colored Girls Museum, a museum that really looks at the world through the lens of the ordinary, extraordinary colored girl.
And that it's in her house? It's part practical. Her three-story home in a historic neighborhood has plenty of space, but it also fits the message of the museum.
This is my house, so it is really and truly a living museum. There was a time when we didn't inhabit these spaces the way that we inhabit them now, and what I mean by we is black folks, colored folks. So there's, in installing work like this, there's a conversation that sort of comes out of the walls that people really haven't heard.
Artist Denise Davis says the setting allows the museum to take on a unique feel.
When you're in a physical museum-type building, kind of stiff and quiet, but this is a place that makes you feel like home.
All three floors of the house are open to visitors. Go up one flight of winding stairs, and you'll run into the exhibit Davis worked on.
We're on the second floor of the museum, and this is a dedication to the washerwoman, an unsung hero.
Davis and her creative partner put together the exhibit to draw attention to the often overlooked role of the washerwoman, a common line of work in the generation of their grandmothers.
It paid the bills, and, you know, it was, thank goodness, because what would people do if they didn't have a means to make money? People need to see that this really existed.
Dubois toyed with the idea of the Colored Girls Museum for a long time, but says it was a project she finally took up following the death of her husband.
One of the things I noticed when I started coming back to life, if you will, is how many things that I had been responsible for weren't done. And it really made me present to how much colored girls do in community.
In the midst of the high-profile deaths of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Freddie Gray, and other black men, she couldn't stop thinking about how the women in their lives were being affected.
These women who are the wives, the mothers, the sisters, the daughters of these tragedies, how they're not going to be present. And in not being present, the community is really going to suffer. I just want to find a way to say, there's love for you while you suffer, while you grieve, while you mourn.
So the Colored Girls Museum was born, first as part of the Philadelphia Fringe Festival, and now in celebration of Women's History Month. Dubois hopes to turn the museum into traveling exhibits, but for now is happy to welcome those interested into her home.
I feel honored because this represents so many people's stories, so many of our generational stories are being held by the objects and the artwork in every single room in this museum.
For WHYY, I'm Nima Roshania.
Finally this evening, breathe in. Spring is in the air. Unless you're detecting an aroma of greasy meat, because today is National Cheesesteak Day. Cheesesteak fans are sharing their cheesesteak love all over the internet by posing for steak selfies. But without a doubt, no one's more excited than the Lehigh Valley Iron Pigs. The minor league baseball team is gearing up for its June 10th Salute to Philadelphia game when it will temporarily change its name to the Lehigh Valley Cheesesteaks. And where there are cheesesteaks, fierce debate isn't far behind. The Iron Pigs are stoking the fires by asking fans with or without. Onion lovers and loathers alike can cast their vote at the team's website, and whichever style of cheesesteak gets the most votes will be seen adoring the team's hats in June. Now, according to the team, your onion preference can tell a lot about how you play ball. Withouts? Well, they're rule-abiding traditionalists. Wits? They're not afraid to play dirty.
Saute those
onions, baby. Grill up the meat.
Ah, that's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Venyakov and Kimberly Haas, with production assistance today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Philly-based guitarist Chris Forsythe has been navigating the world of modern independent music for years, and his newest project, Chris Forsythe and the Solar Motel Band, is primed to release a new album this week. We'll hear a preview on tomorrow's show. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.